had all the decisions made in my mind when I went into politics. A lot of guys go into politics, and gals, they go in young, you know, and they make the decisions as they go along politically. And this is an expedient. Oh, I never did think about the death penalty. What should I think about the death penalty? Ooh, I better think it's a good idea because I just saw a poll. You know, and so you get influenced by your environment. When you're in business, you learn about business. That's a very good thing to have behind you when you're a politician. You know, when I went in my first job, Secretary of State, and I saw the way they made a budget, I had been on the boards of corporations. I'd learned a lot about making budgets and a lot about business practices. I said, this is an atrocity. When I talked to them about zero-based budgeting in 1975, they didn't know what I was talking about. At that time, zero-based budgeting was already a well-understood concept, at least academically, in business circles. So the experience you bring from any other activity is a plus in politics. So in many ways, I'm at a disadvantage for having, I was at a disadvantage for having started late. In many ways, I was at a great advantage for having started late, because I learned a lot, I brought a lot to politics that a lot of these people who were there for a whole lifetime before me never got to learn. And you know, you can get remote from reality as a politician. They make you governor for 12 years. You know, you can get very far away from the reality of everyday life. You never go into your pocket for 12 years. You never have to tip a captain, you know, pay a bill. For 12 years, your money means nothing. You never pay a bill. First of all, you have to assign some accountant to do all your books so that you don't get into trouble, you know, with campaign funding and all of that. So he does that for you, and you never pay for anything. I want to go shopping for Matilda. And all the cameras are there. You know, and so you just buy things, and then somebody sends you a bill later on. You never take any money. You never see the bill. Matilda never did so well as when I was governor. I never saw the bills. I just bought the stuff. Who knew what it cost? So the answer is, I think the experience is a good thing, not a bad thing. Especially corporate experience and business experience. Yes?
Governor Cuomo, I'd like to return to the 80% of moderate and low-skill workers that you talked about at the beginning
80,
of your...
80,
yeah,
right.
80%. Accepting the moral imperative of taking care of that group and of advancing their interests, I want to pose a hard question about education. I'm sure you recall the study that your colleague Daniel Patrick Moynihan was fond of quoting, that educational results were more highly correlated to proximity to the Canadian border than they were with spending. And if that's true, if money isn't enough, and if we take that as a hypothesis, or at least a pretty reasonable idea, if money isn't enough, what is? What is the right solution? What is the right approach? Or do you refute the premise, is money enough?
I may be misunderstanding you, but it sounds as though you're suggesting that money is irrelevant.
No. Simply that spending alone hasn't seemed to work.
Oh, absolutely, spending alone hasn't.
Now,
do you think Pat Moynihan would have said that about defense when we had $400 for a toilet seat?
I think his point was that there may be some social issues which are more or less readily addressed by spending. And maybe, I don't know, maybe education is
no,
one of them. But
no,
like,
he didn't.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, okay, let's take it. First of all, I want to get clear the main issue about spending. On defense, we don't allow ourselves the intellectual luxury of quibbling about whether it's quality spending. As a matter of fact, I'll never forget this. I had a debate with, I forget who it was, maybe it was Jim Baker. I said, how do you, I've heard you twice say that the defense budget is too low because, and then you use as a measurement, percentage of gross national product. I said, can you tell me how you can equate what we need for defense through percentages of the gross national product? We had a grocery store. If someone came in and said, the doctor says my children are suffering from malnutrition, and my mother said, well, how much of your weekly check do you pay on food? And she says, 5%. And my mother said, make it 9%. Would that be an intelligent answer? Of course not. Well, then how can a percentage of gross national product have any intelligence at all as a measurement of what you're spending on defense? Doesn't what you're spending on, how you spend, what you spend for weapons, what you spend for personnel, what you spend for research, isn't that relevant? And the answer is, of course. Well, then why did they do this? Because it was convenient politically, and it worked politically, because the dummies out there said, yeah, that's right, you know, war, it's lower as a percentage of gross national product. And if you did that, who would ever examine for waste? If that were the only criteria, then you give them the money and they spend it, because it's no longer relevant that they spent $400 for a toilet seat, which they did, as only one example. So let's get clear on budgets. You know, let's be realistic about it. Proposition: is government money wasted? Does Harvard waste its budget money? Absolutely. Everybody wastes. Everybody is inefficient. All of business, all of the expenditure of money gets involved with waste the way you get involved with crabgrass if you try to grow a lawn at home. It's there all the time, and you have to be rooting it out all the time. There's always waste. It's a human condition, and that's true in government, sometimes more so in government, because you don't have a bottom line profit loss. That's a given. With education, with welfare, with the Resolution Trust Corporation, was there waste? We just saw $100 billion worth of waste this 2 weeks ago. The court revealed it, and how we spent money trying to solve the savings and loan problem. Has there been waste in education? Of course there is some waste in education. You spent money on bureaucracy in New York City that you should not. It's too big. In some places, teachers got too much money. It was wrong. In some places, the milk money for the cafeteria was ripped off by a teacher. She should go to jail. Of course we should spend money intelligently. But to take Moynihan's remark and say, that means we can't do it by just giving money. Now let me give you some additional facts. You have 55 million public school children in primary, elementary, secondary. You have about 5 million people in private. The 55 million in public school are divided in two parts. Kids who live in prosperous or middle class communities. Education there is good, at least, and in some places excellent. The other is kids who live in poor communities. Education there is abominable to poor. That's a reality. So let's focus on that. Why is the expenditure in the poor areas, and the expenditure in the poor areas is at least as high as it is in the other places? No question about that. Well then, why is it that they don't do well? Because there are social problems? Absolutely. Because the schools are older and more deteriorated? Absolutely. Because these social problems would require smaller class sizes to be efficient? Absolutely. Because these social problems and the disadvantages these kids start with would require more schooling than 180 days a year? Well, we should have that for everybody, because they're going to school 240 days, 230 days, 220 days, we're going 180, they're beating our brains out. 51% of the students in Stuyvesant High School that I built for $127 million are Asian, winning scholarships. Only 12% of the population of the city, less, is Asian. But they beat everybody else in math and science to get into Stuyvesant High School, the best high school, free, it's a public school, in the world. $127 million I paid to. Why? Because they have a culture where they go to school 220 days, 230 days, especially math and science. So we should all go to school more. But certainly those poor kids should go more. Should they all be introduced to education as early as possible. When I was growing up, that wasn't the thing. You know, you waited until you were 5 or 6 before you sent the kid, or the kid would be spoiled. But now we all understand those early years are the most important years. That's what Head Start is all about. All of those things cost money. They're terrific investments. Head Start is a great investment. We have never fully funded Head Start. We need $110 billion to repair public schools. We gave $600 billion in tax cuts, and when a senator put the hand up and said, you have a bill here from the General Accounting Office, a statement that says we need $110 billion to repair public schools, the local schools can't possibly pay that, can we give them $5 billion just to show we know it's a problem? They said, we can't afford it. I didn't make that up. Now, you give me the logic. Maybe I missed something. I'm getting carried away now. See, this is senescence. The next stop is, you know, oatmeal and somebody. Computers. It's an information superhighway. I've heard that so much from the politicians. We're going to put all the kids on the information superhighway. The information superhighway is a toll road. You can't get on it unless you have a computer. When I was growing up, PS50, PS50 was a good school. I'll tell you how good it was. There's a school called Number 50, which is the pride of Calfit Lawn, and it stands for the things that are the best, and the boys and girls that enter it. I remember the damn school song. Why? Because it left such an impression on me, because these people were so good to me, because these I remember how Mrs. Kilgallen's perfume smelled. That's how intimate my association was with that school, because I loved going there, all right? And when you went to the Queensboro Public Library, because there were no books in your house, and you didn't have any books, and you didn't have a real library at PS50, when you went to the Queensboro Public Library, they had everything in the library. You were a poor kid from South Jamaica, you had to go to the other side of the tracks, literally, and there was this beautiful library. Anybody could use it. And you could put slides and all sorts of high technology. We should have libraries like that everywhere. Every kid who wanted it should be able to go and have a computer. The truth is, every kid should have a computer at home. It is as vital as the shoes that you're giving the kid to wear. And we all know that. And they should be able to use it. And they should be able to learn from it. And virtual university is the future. We all are going to have to stay high-skilled and to stay with this increasing, you know, lifting of the bar, which is wonderful. To stay with that, we're going to have virtual universities for the rest of our lives. We're going to have to learn from laptops forever. You're going to be studying forever, whatever profession you're in. The law, you know, it's going to get more and more complicated. We should have that. That costs money. And what we refuse to acknowledge, and we create all these excuses, like Pat Moynihan's, pardon me, but Pat Moynihan's statement. Like, well, we tried spending money and it didn't work. Really? Let's stop paying for defense. We paid all that money for defense. Look at what happened. They started a war in Kosovo. If that's the way they're going to be, the hell with them. We won't spend any more on defense. You have to spend money. Just don't waste it. Can you do that? Yes. The federal government should raise the money. Why? Because you have $4 trillion in surplus. That's why. I don't have $4 trillion in surplus. Nobody else has it. You have it. So we're going to take it from you. And you're not going to run education. Why? You're no good at running anything. You paid $400 for a toilet seat. We don't trust you to run anything. Just give us the money and go away. You may, however, hold us accountable. Make sure, for example, that the scores start going up, that the class sizes, investigate. Have an army of investigators if you want. That's good. Accountability is good. But let us do it at the local level. That's the way it should work. There is no good argument against it. No good. They invent these dilettante arguments for the ignorant, like vouchers. I'll bet some people here think vouchers is a good idea. I can smell it. Listen to that. You tell me how with vouchers, how many of the 55 million kids in the public school you're going to move into private school if there are only 5 million private students? How many empty seats are there in those private schools? How many kids are you going to move with vouchers? If there were no other argument, no constitutional argument, no argument of draining, no argument of unfairness, if there were none of those arguments, how are you going to make any appreciable difference without building new schools? You want us to build the new schools too? Build them with public money? And give it to who? The yeshivas? To St. Monica? To whom? How does it work? And didn't you say, especially you conservatives that want vouchers, that education was a local issue? Absolutely want to get rid of the Department of Education. Terrific. Do the local boards now have the right to vote for vouchers? Absolutely. How many of the many thousands of school districts have? 5. Terrific. When you get to 500, give me a ring. I mean, if 5, after all of this talk, 5, they can vote for it tomorrow. They haven't voted. What is it? It is a way to keep you from saying, let's put money in the budget so they can take the money, declare a big tax cut, and get a lot of votes from, they're not going to get any votes from the public school people, and they know it. They're not going to get any votes from the welfare people, because the welfare people are 2/3 children. 2/3 children. And that's why they were such an easy target. Who the heck is going to vote against you? The kids? The infants? No. Their mothers, who barely have the incentive, you know, to survive, you know, after what's happened to them. No, they're not going to vote against you. The immigrant, who's getting hurt the most by all of this? The immigrants, the poor, the non-voters. Who does the best? The voters, senior citizens. Don't ever try taking anything away from senior citizens. What? They vote. Patrick Moynihan. I like Pat, though. He's good. He got off the best line of, he really got off a line I should have used, defining down deviance. And that's a wonderful, because that's what all this politics is about, defining down excellence, defining down ambition. Harvard has one thing, before I leave, I've got to get this in, that really distinguishes you in a lot of ways, holy ambition. You know, there's ambition that can be scurrilous and cheap and tawdry. You've got holy ambition. Harvard teaches you to excel because they know you have the potential to excel, and so they teach you to excel. That's wonderful. To excel in every way you can, to distinguish yourself, to make them proud of the fact that you came out of Harvard, to make yourself proud of the fact that you do. That's what we had as a people for a long time. That's what created the period of the American dream, a common ambition. The whole country said, we're not going to let this depression happen, and so they decided to pool strengths to bail themselves out of the depression. They not only pooled strengths for that, they pooled strengths to bring back Europe with the Marshall Plan, and Japan, with dollars. Why? Because we need them for markets and to avoid chaos. So we're going to make our, we're ambitious to be the greatest nation in world history. To do that, we have to share our wealth with one another, of course. Public schools, that's when the public schools really started getting the best sharing device of all, the public schools. And that ambition is what made us great. That ambition is what Kennedy used to get us into outer space. I mean, what did he say? All he said was, we should be the first in outer space. Nobody knew what outer space was. Nobody knew why we should be the first in outer space. But they said we should be first. Now, ambition is gone. They're discouraging ambition. They're saying, you're trying to do too much. This is as good as it gets. And if you try to help all those people Cuomo's talking about, if you try to help the weak, you're going to weaken the strong. And that's a lot of garbage. If you said that and meant it, then what are you doing with the IMF? Why are you trying to help Malaysia? Why are you trying to help all these other weak parts of the world? Why are you in Russia? Their economy is the size of Delaware. Why are we there? Because we're afraid of the missiles? Because we can't afford to have them in chaos? We share our wealth and strength with them because we need them to make this a peaceful and more civilized world. That's the truth. And our ambition to do that had no bounds. Now, IMF, in the last poll I saw, rejected by 65% of the American people. World Bank, rejected by about the same amount. What are they saying? Isolationism just around the corner. Not yet. Because fortunately, we got Pat Buchanan and a couple of other, you know, guys who don't sell it too well, selling it. But, you know, it has an appeal, and it's a great danger. Go ahead. Two more. Let's go.
Yes, sir. You alluded before to polling results and how they shape right. agendas. My question is that a lot of the issues you've raised today, whether it be education, right. low-income housing, those are tough issues with right. not easy answers. And when a candidate's presented with the prospect of trying to build consensus on issues like those, Do you think that the current campaigning and electoral system and the discourse that it shapes are inadequate for building consensus on difficult issues? And do you think changes need to be made as far as funding, as far as structure, in order to advance those?
I think the thing you need and the thing you don't get in the current politics and the current political discourse is subtlety. The discourse is commandeered now by television, media, which puts a premium on brevity. I have to go to do a debate in a couple of weeks, and they sent me this format. And they said, we're going to ask each of the speakers 15 questions, complicated issues. We won't give you the issues because we want to assure spontaneity. And you're limited to 55 seconds on each. Why didn't they make it a minute? I don't know. 55 seconds on each. Then I sent it back and I said, forget about it, I'm not coming. Why? Because 55 seconds on, you can't do it. I can't do vouchers in 55 seconds. And you can't tell the truth in a 28-second commercial, but that's what works best, is a 28-second commercial. Whether it's Morning in America, that BBDNO, I guess, did for Ronald Reagan, or the most fantastically potent of all commercials ever, played one day and it was so powerful they had to take it off, was the Bill Birnbach, who I had the great privilege of knowing as a young man. As a matter of fact, I represented him. Doyle Dane Birnbach, he did the Volkswagen bug. He did Levy's, you don't have to be Jewish to enjoy Levy's. He did the exploding atom bomb against Lyndon Johnson against Barry Goldwater, only played one night. It was a little girl with a flower, and in the back there was the atom bomb's sequelae. And it was so chilling and so frightening that they said, it's too much, it's bad, and they took it off. So, everything now is geared to one-liners, slogans. The era of big government is over. That's a winner. That's a winner. Don't feed the alligators or the crocodiles. Do you remember that down south? They were talking about welfare. Don't feed the alligators. And they used it as a campaign. It worked. It worked. We should have taken away their statehood. So that's what you have in politics. What should you have? You should never have a 28-second commercial. Great Britain, no 28-second commercials. You should have more money coming from the government for campaign funding with strictures. We're going to give you the money, but you're going to have this kind of debate with the money. We're going to give you the money, but no 28-second commercials. You have to have 3-minute commercials or whatever they are, and you have to be in them, and you have to speak. You have to subject yourself to inquisition by reporters that we'll select. You know, so you make up the rules. This is what you have to do. Now, in between, we'll give you $12.90. Do whatever you want. You know, go from door to door. And I would encourage a lot of that old-fashioned campaigning where you made them go out and you made them get head-to-head with people and you made them go back and forth. That's the way I beat Koch in 1982. He spent $5 million, I spent $1 million, then Lou Lerman spent $13 million, I spent $4 million. And that was my first race for governor, and I just barely won against Lerman because he buried us in death penalty commercials last week. He bought so much television, we couldn't buy any. That's a literal truth, and that led to a lawsuit and a change in policy. We couldn't, they said we don't have any more space. You know, wherever you went, Lou, he owned Rite Aid or something. So yes, you have to change the way things are. Now, problem, why don't they change it? Why don't they change campaign financing? Didn't Gingrich and Clinton shake hands once and say we're going to have a bipartisan committee? Yeah, because neither one of them wants to change it. Why not? Well, because incumbents profit from it. Now, the only one who really should want to change it is an outgoing president, because he has term limits and he can't run again. But the people who can run again, they don't want to change it, because once you're an incumbent, it works in your favor. See, term limits would have taken care of that, but now a lot of these guys who said they were going to do term limits have changed their mind because they, you know, they like the health care, they like the check, they like the power, and they want to stay in office. But there is no thrust to change campaign financing because they don't really want to change it. If they did, they would have changed it. Now I'm talking about both the Democrats and the Republicans. Of course, once you're incumbent, at what percentage do incumbents win legislatively? 90? 93%? How come they win 93% of the time, 90% of the time? Because they have all the advantages. They have the postage, and they have the money that comes pouring in from all the big corporations. If only to protect yourself from the unhappiness of the politician, you give them money. If they're, especially if they're political chair people. They had important committees as chairs. So, yeah, the answer is it has to be changed. It has to be changed dramatically. Who can change it? Only people like you. Only a whole new wave of interest and protest and intelligence and energy coming from the people. And who's going to start that? Only people like you. Why? Because you'll have all the gifts, all the talent, all the capacity, and you'll have more of the opportunity than the others will have. It's as simple as that. And you're not obliged to do it, obviously. And many of you won't. And if you don't, it's going to be this way 20 years from now. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Governor Cuomo. Unlike the gentleman who made a comment earlier, I'm of the mind that money does solve every problem. I'm of the mind that money does solve a lot of our problems. And
money does solve a lot of your problems.
Yeah. And in regard to what you mentioned before about education and us having to import most of our skilled workers in.
Not most. No, no, no. 115,000 this year. Not most.
Okay.
Because 20% of our workers are high skilled. As 160 million workers altogether. So that's a considerable number. But we do import computer engineers, 115,000 this year, 65,000 last year, which is too many. But go ahead.
And other problems like health care. That has to be taken in consideration with the fact that we have 2% of the country controlling 80% of the wealth. And the money and the participation and a lot of the brain work has to come from this group of people. But yet, it often considered political suicide to even suggest that that they participate. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions for us as far as what we can do to make our clients, our constituents,
yeah,
our colleagues.
I think you have to make a deal. See, we have to make a deal. And first of all, we have to get some party, if not the Democrats, the Republicans, if not them, the liberals or the progressives or the new party. I invented a party, the Neighborhood Preservation Party, and got 64,000 votes on a line. Just make up a name, and sometimes that's an advantage because it's a tabula rasa. You know, you can write a new message on it because it's not been written on before. But somebody has to take the lead on this. And once again, that's you. What deal would you make? You go to the wealthy people, and first of all, you take all the wealth of the country and you say to them, "Look, I'm for you." You tell them the story about Mama and Lee Iacocca. I want everybody to make 20 million. Mama was there, so am I. You know, and what do you want now to make more wealth in the years? You want free trade. Yeah, you're after us on NAFTA. You want to make it AFTA. I didn't like NAFTA. I was the only governor in the United States to vote against it. I said it wouldn't work, and it didn't. I don't care what you say. If you want to bring me back for debate on that, I'd be pleased to. But I like the notion of free trade, of, you know, the inevitability of free trade in this society. Not absolutely free, we have to find better language. As free a trade as you can manage, you know, given the realities that we're all going to have certain things we want to protect. That's absolutely true. So you want more free trade, you want this special provision for the president to be able to make a deal without the Congress. Let's put that down. Okay, what else you want? You want deregulation and privatization? You want us to put an emphasis on that? Hey, I'm with Abraham Lincoln. I believe that government is the coming together of people to do for one another collectively what they could not do as well or at all privately. And if they can do it privately, it should be done privately. Government is not virtuous, you know, per se. It is there to do the things that you can't do privately. Only when it's needed, all the government you need, but only the government you need. Therefore, if you accept that, I will look at every function to see whether or not we can do it privately. Prisons, and I did that. Prisons. Can you do private prisons? We tried, doesn't work. Why? Because they don't know how to run prisons. And the profit motive in running prisons doesn't go together. How about sending out the laundry to private people? Terrific, I did that, it does work. How about doing the kitchens through private companies? Terrific, I tried that, it does work. I spent $75 billion on infrastructure, $75 billion. That was more than Rockefeller, $75 billion on roads, bridges, institutions of various kinds. Who did the construction work for the state? Well, they used to have armies of state people doing it. I hired consultants. I did private business. Why? Because I thought it was more efficient. I ran studies. I did it. I saw how it worked. I could do it more efficiently without using the government. That is an intelligent approach. That's privatization. I propose selling the World Trade Center. The World Trade Center belongs to New York and New Jersey. I said, what are we doing in the real estate business when I need money for education? Let's sell it. Oh, the seller, gee, they never sold it. It's a big asset. I know it's a big asset. That's why I want to sell it. Sell it. And now George Pataki, who's followed me, is trying to cut a deal with Chrissy Whitman to sell the world. So give them privatization. Give them deregulation. Taxes, I'm not going to raise your taxes for 2 years. But now you have to give me something back. Now, all these things are good for free enterprise, and I want free enterprise to succeed because in the end, that's the way all of us are going to make it. You're not going to get rich on a public payroll. You're not going to build a strong economy on a public payroll. All right, public jobs, you know, they help you out. But you can't build it. You have to build the economy on a free enterprise theory. So I'm all for that. I'm not against that. But now I need wealth to capacitate these people in my old neighborhood to get into that free enterprise system. By improving their public schools, giving them access. I had Liberty Scholarships program. No one would be denied 4 years of college in the state university. You'd have to pay it back, you know, but it wasn't a whole lot. When I left, it was $1,300, I think, plus transportation, plus room and board in some cases. Liberty Scholarship program. I think that's a very good investment. Why? We would have more high-skilled workers than anybody if I could have stayed there and perfected that program. So you make a deal. You go to the rich people and say, look, I'm with you as much as I am with them. I want them to be you. And what you're saying is, no, you know, you want to keep all the profits for yourself and keep them down. It won't work. That gap is getting bigger and bigger. And sooner or later, it's going to explode. It's bigger now than it has ever been. And sooner or later, those 160 million workers are going to figure this thing out. And somebody's going to get up there who is plausible and believable and tell them they're both conning you, the Democrats and the Republicans. Everybody's taking care of Cuomo and his clients. And meanwhile, you're not getting a fair share. And forget about fairness and forget about morality. It's not intelligent to be importing workers. It's not intelligent to have struggling middle-class people instead of having what Mario was from 45 to 75, the period of the American dream. Every year we made more money. Every year we did better. Every year we went up the ladder. Everybody was happier. Everybody. I know it's a different world. I know we have globalization to deal with. We're smart enough to do it. We figured out how to win the Second World War when we started with nothing. We figured out how to get into space when we started with nothing. We can be as smart as we have to be. It's a matter of will. It's not a matter of capacity. We have the capacity, just a matter of will. Someday that'll happen, and then they're going to turn on you. It's not going to be a revolution, but they're going to tax your tush, baby, and they're going to drive you down, and they'll find other ways to share this wealth. Why don't you do it this way? Invest in them. We're not going to waste your money. We're not going to throw it away. We're not going to give anybody a free ride. Hey, my father nearly worked himself to death just to get me an education, just to put me in a position where I could learn the English language. I'm not about to give anything away for nothing. You make that speech to them, get them to listen to it. You can make a deal. That's the way we can sell this thing. And it works. Who will be able to sell it better, though, than you? If not you, then who? And if not now, when? Thank you.